Welcome to another edition of, we still haven't come up with a title for this entirely, but...
Faculty Profile Series?
Faculty Profile Series? I like that quite a bit. I like that quite a bit. I am Nick Messina, specialist professor here in the Department of Communication here at Monmouth University, along with my my coworker, Matt Harmon. We're trying to sit down with everybody in our department, try and get to know them a little bit better, and, you know, get into what I like to think of the secret lives, if you will, or the secret lives of professors.
That will end up being so boring, after all.
Not by any means. Not by any means. In fact, I don't think we'll be bored by any means. Sitting across from me right now, Dr. Marina Wunjevic, associate professor here in the Department of Communication. She is also the faculty council chair, the author of Forging with Bubikoff Nation.
Forging
the Bubikoff Nation.
That's right.
I don't know why I said with. I have the Journalism, Gender, and Modernity in Interwar Yugoslavia, Participatory Journalism, Guarding Open Gates at Online Newspapers, and most recently, Global Communication, a Multicultural Perspective, third edition. Marina, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Nick. My pleasure.
Now, like I said, we want to see if we can, you know, get into the backgrounds and get into the backstories of some of the folks here in our department. Now, you bring a particularly unique background to the journalism and PR concentration or cluster here in the department, being that you are a native of Croatia, correct?
Correct.
And 2003 is when you came here?
Yeah, that's correct. 2003, to pursue my graduate education.
And you were at which university did you study at?
I did my master's at University of Northern Iowa, and then I pursued my PhD in journalism and mass comm at University of Iowa. Not that far from University of Northern Iowa. University of Northern Iowa is in Cedar Falls, mm-hmm. and only about an hour and a half south in Iowa City, I did my PhD.
Oh, so you weren't in Ames, though?
No, that's Iowa State.
Oh, good Lord.
Which is another excellent school in a Iowa State system, but yeah, I went to University of Iowa.
That's the only one that I'm familiar with at this point. I've been there twice, shockingly enough, but
that is shocking because I meet a lot of people from New Jersey or in this area that
go out
I
that
say
way.
Iowa. No, when oh. I say Iowa, they're like, what?
Oh yeah, that's we always think it's one of the square states in the middle.
That's right.
We're not exactly sure 100%.
Yep. It's a pretty awesome place. I mean, everyone's heard of Iowa because of the Iowa caucuses, but
oh, that's right.
It's not election year. People tend to forget or confuse it with Idaho.
Oh, that's unfortunate. If we only have 50 states to remember, it shouldn't
that's
be
right.
that shouldn't be that difficult by any means.
Yep.
What kind of transition was that like for you coming from Croatia to Iowa to complete your studies?
Well, I always like to say it was probably more of a transition coming from Iowa to New Jersey than from Croatia to Iowa.
Really?
Because, you know, I mean, yeah, I grew up watching American television. Of course, Iowa ended up nothing like what you see in Friends, you know, for example. But at least, you know, I had some expectations about how different it's going to be. Certain things were familiar because, as I said, you know, from the mass communication, TV, etc. But, you know, other things were new and I just enjoyed learning. But my expectation for coming from Iowa to New Jersey is just going to be more of the same. You know, it's America, right? But the cultural differences are pretty huge.
Oh, absolutely.
Between like middle of the country and the coasts. I would assume the same with California, although I didn't spend much time there.
It's funny, you know, I don't think that we realize how big of a country we are. So yeah, mm-hmm. going
it's a continent.
It is humongous, you know. Yeah. I am blown away, you know, blown away whenever I have to go down south or out west. I cannot wait to return to the Northeast the majority of the time, but it is important to get out there. Now, you began your career and your studies in journalism, again, in Croatia, in a
correct.
Essentially in newly founded or newly established Croatia,
mm-hmm.
correct?
Yeah, it was really during the tail end of the Civil War in former Yugoslavia. Yeah, Croatia was established in 1990 as a new independent state. And yeah, I started my undergraduate education in 1993.
Oh, wow. So really right in the, essentially right in the middle of the, war.
Yeah, the war sort of ended in 1995. And then you had the, you know, post-war years that were not so fun, but neither was the war.
Is that what made you gravitate towards journalism? You know, kind of being this, we refer to it here, you know, in the United States as being the fourth estate, you know, the watchers of the watchmen, if you will. Is that what made you gravitate towards the industry and towards the career of being a journalist?
I mean, I think like most of students, undergraduate students, those of whom might be listening to us or those who might be actually high school students that are looking to find their program, I fell into journalism sort of accidentally. It's just, in a way, beauty of it. You know, you might have some preconceived notions of like what your future might look like. And, you know, I really wanted to study comparative literature and English language because I was the best in my class in English, but then I took a test to qualify for free education because we have a merit test, you know. I actually flunked it. I got accepted to comparative literature, but you can study comparative literature as a major, only kind of as a double major.
Yeah.
And I just did not have another outlet, so that sort of fell through the cracks. And my mom was like, wow, you always like news. And I said, well, you're right. At age 9, I actually started doing news clippings, and I had a scrapbook of news clippings. And I remember, like, so vividly this, you know, Time magazine cover when Indira Gandhi was shot in the early 80s. And it was an image of her holding her heart in the shape of India with like three holes in it, like bleeding.
Oh my God.
And I was like so powerful. And so I started to look for like, you know, magazines that would come to our house or at the library and, you know, whatever my neighbors gave me, any newspapers, and I found an article interesting or a cartoon or whatever, I would make those clippings. And I did that for years. But even then, I didn't think of, you know, myself as potential journalists in future. And then during the war, I remember, you know, when the war started, I was in high school, and there were all these interesting stories about, you know, our government and their role in the war. And there was this cartoon again of all of the politicians, leaders in former Yugoslavia sitting around a cake. And they all sort of with knives cutting pieces, like who's going to grab the bigger piece of the cake. And that was really powerful. So, yeah, I always had sort of interest in this area, but I never made a connection until my mom said, you know, well, this is sort of, I see you in this area. You argue points really well, and that's good for a journalist. And, you know, I think journalists perform one of the most important roles in society. She said, you know, Marina, we wouldn't know anything if there wasn't journalists.
Right.
And I was like, Mom, that is really true. And I do see a point. I do have interest in that, although I never made it so conscious, you know. And I took a test, and I was 29th in the country. They were accepting 70 students for like tuition-free education. And I remember they, you know, make lists public of everybody who got accepted. I pushed through like a crowd of people, and I saw my name. It said accepted. And I ran outside, and I jumped, and I said, I'm going to be a journalist. And there were all these like senior students sort of like, you know, their faces were like, what's she so excited about, you know, like probably before test or something, you know, standing outside. And, you know, that's really, you know, made me into this like passionate journalism student. And, you know,
I find that that's such an important story for you to tell us, because, you know, sitting with some other folks so far, there's been this common thread of, I was 8, I was 9, I was 10, I was 11 years old. I was playing, you know, pretending to make radio shows, you know, doing cuttings of newspapers, pretending to make movies. But I didn't think that this was actually something that I would wind up doing and pursuing and would be a viable career option.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that's I think, is huge, you know, more than anything else. There's something in us that we're going towards that. We're going towards that more than anything.
Look at your toy box.
Exactly.
And see what you played with the most.
Now we
and
just
that
gotta,
might be, you know, telling you what where your real interests are.
Now we just got to get rid of the iPads first. Once they get rid of the iPads, that's
right.
when they can get into that. Now, you've done quite a bit of research about, a lot of your research is about kind of journalism and subsequently identity in these digital realms. What sort of impact do you see kind of like manifesting as a result of having, you know, almost a generation, two generations almost now of students that grew up in this, really don't know life without the internet, don't know life without living kind of these digital forums. Do you see any differences maybe in the classroom or?
Well, sometimes I'm sort of puzzled with the students who are in my journalism courses, but they don't follow news. Or they get news from social media only, right?
Yeah.
So this idea that somehow, you know, news is all around and you don't need to pursue it, you know, knowledge of news or sort of in-depth understanding of news or more in-depth understanding of news coverage on particular issues. I'm also sometimes puzzled that students have difficulty identifying what issues they care about.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so I think one of the big roles that I see educators must do is to sort of awaken that understanding of like what the real role of journalism is, right? Importance of journalism in any society, but particularly in democratic societies, and also to sort of awaken this need to be passionate about at least one issue in the world you would like to know more about. And the more you know about, you have a need to tell that story to other people. So the storytelling component. And, you know, I don't blame the students. Like I said, I was pretty unconscious of my own interests and even like what my career goals would be. But, you know, I guess my goal as an educator to sort of awaken that passion and have them, you know, start pursuing, asking those questions of themselves. What really is that I care the most about? And then trying to learn about it to a point where you want to tell a story about it.
I try to do the exact same thing, and you're right, preface the same way. Yeah, at 19, at 20 years old, I really didn't, you know, I won't say I didn't care, but I wasn't paying attention. I you know, I wasn't, you know, made informed, and it wasn't until I had a professor who used to make us read the New York Times from front to back. And I explain it to them now, I'm like, after a while, it starts to read like a soap opera, like a drama. You learn the good guys or the perceived good guys and bad guys,
right.
You know, who's kind of doing what behind whose back and what kind of repercussions. And then when you start to develop these relationships and you follow these narratives and these plot points, yeah, you almost start to think, okay, what's going to happen next? I'm looking forward to the next episode, the next edition. I'm fascinated by it. And again, you know, seeing that spark, you know, kind of light that fire.
It is a really fascinating process, and it's really telling the story of our time in a real time while we are living it, not from a historical perspective. You know, it's really told, and hopefully when journalists do their job, from eyewitness accounts, from perspectives of the regular people who otherwise don't see themselves as participants in a history, right? And I think the opportunity for regular people to participate in news production, which is what one of my books is about the participatory journalism practices in online media and beyond, is about this promise with the internet in particular that, you know, people, eyewitnesses would have more impact on news production.
Do you find that there's a trade-off between that encouraging that participatory nature of journalism and the credibility, the validity of the facts that are being then disseminated?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. You know, when my group of scholars from around the world, my friends and my colleagues, and we are sort of plotting to another project, which would be sort of 10 years, you know, more than 10 years.
Oh, really?
After, you know, we started this book, 2008 is when, you know, the book was done. And so we are sort of looking at 2008 as a time when we were very optimistic, maybe somewhat delusional about the promise of participatory journalism or regular people's participation and contribution, that somehow it will lead to more democracy, you know, that marketplace of ideas, yeah. Promise, you know, that, you know, the more voices, the better. But of course, over the course of years, we've seen that that did not necessarily pan out. And I don't think that's the problem of the, you know, regular people just simply don't tell the truth, or they don't contribute to the news production in a proper way, right?
Yeah.
I think it's more of additional, continuous, hyper corporatization of the media, including the social media, the tech giants like Facebook and Google and others, have managed to hijack the democratic process, including the information, including the news, right?
Yeah.
And they've allowed it to morph into something that's neither informational nor newsworthy in many instances, and more dangerously not correct. And that's something that we are going to try to explore. You know, even in the piece in 2008, I probably, and I think my colleagues would agree, had the more bleak sort of my friend David, who is one of the co-authors, who would say, well, you're pessimist and I'm optimist. And I'm like, yeah, I guess I'm pessimist, but I looked at things from more of the from a political economic perspective. And you know, what was the real impetus for any organization to go even into participatory journalism, user-generated content? And whenever I talk to journalists or editors in various newspapers, they all said that all the impetus is the competition, yeah. The economic competition advantage, right? It never was truly about democratizing the voice or, you know, getting more people. You know, of course, maybe they would market it that way. But in the background, the truth reality was, you know, we have to jump on that bandwagon or otherwise we'll disappear.
Wow. Yeah. Post-capitalism eat or be eaten mentality. And yeah, the way that it's subsequently impacted the news. And I guess one of the questions that I do have, and if I may, you know, I did a little research as well.
Great,
right? I should preface as well that Marina was one of my fine professors here at Monmouth as well when I was in my master's program.
And Nick was a very fine student.
Thank you. Goodness, I hope so. But one of the things that had popped up was, after or just before and after Croatia, you know, about 30 years ago now, did declare.
Was it really?
I think I saw December of 1990 was when it was voted on.
That's
yeah.
Right. That's
yeah.
Right.
One of the things that had happened was that, you know, saw this rise in nationalism. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of, you know, you've got in that particular area, you've got individuals that identify as Croat and Serbian and Bosnian and Macedonian and all these different...
And Yugoslav still?
And oh, that's right, yes. And Slavs, of course. I forgot those as well. What sort of juxtaposition do you think might exist between that region of the world 30 years ago and, let's say, being here in the United States today, where we do see so many, you know, so much strife, if you will, as a result of the kind of compartmentalization of mm-hmm. these groups within the public sphere, all trying to interact in a democratic society?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, Nick, you mentioned you were my student. You're a very fine student in my global communication course.
This is about you. This isn't about me.
And in that course, we did discuss, you know, very important planetary process called globalization, mm-hmm. right? And when you look at the research from the past 30 years, when people start to talk about whether there is such a thing as globalization, and some, you know, equated it with economic expansion of capitalism, basically an American model, expansion of American influence around the world. So some say it's simply Americanization and nothing else. But certainly, you know, not to get into theory too much, there is something evidently going on. And I think that fall of Yugoslavia, to say that way, was in part a victim of this process of globalization that perhaps started, you know, right after the Second World War, as, you know, America started to expand its influence around the world. And for that influence, you had, you know, cultural sort of what we call imperialism, you know, massive amounts of exporting culture, which wasn't just, you know, sort of accidentally we exported because we have the means, but also policies and other ways in which, you know, countries have signed contracts with Americans for record industry, from record industry to films to other things. I mean, there is a great number of books and literature out there that does a remarkable job at explaining that to us. So in that process, I think, you know, Yugoslavia just fell a victim because it was sort of a mixed economy model between capitalism and socialism, and politicians sort of in the grab for in a process of you know, transplanting a new economic model, relied on what they knew the best, that would work the best, which is, you know, nationalist ideologists. You know, how do you succeed is you divide the people and you rise to the top. And you had that, you know, sort of bloody war going forward. And so I think that how we could perhaps see this whole process is, you know, globalization had a promise of, you know, homogeneity, cultural homogeneity, people will be more similar, therefore there will be no reason to fight over anything. But what we've seen is, you know, problems around lack of resources, economic decisions that, you know, make poor countries sometimes even more poor and more dependent. In other cases, you know, globalization has led to some advancement to certain countries like Taiwan and, you know, others. But in most cases, it kept low wages, poor conditions, and environmental issues persistent. And in addition to, you know, bringing new factories and no regulations that affected negatively many, many countries in the world. So even though the story isn't, you know, just black or white, you know, I think that what you're seeing is somewhat of a backlash towards the globalization and that sort of unity and one globe, one nation, one, you know, culture, global culture. You know, backlash always happens when people feel sort of betrayed by, you know, you have, you know, even people in the West, like in UK, you know, people felt that they were betrayed in a process. In America, you know, today just heard on the news of a closure of a GM factory in Ohio. There was a huge, you know, people across the country felt betrayed. And coupled with the 2008 global economic crisis, which additionally confirmed that, you know, it's mostly those on the top, the 1%, that are getting, you know, richer, for whom, you know, the trade markets really work. And but for the rest of the people, you know, they're still probably in the same wage that they were in late 90s or early 2000s. Like in last 20 years, nothing much changed for them. In fact, the change that is coming is potentially loss of jobs and security that they've had. And I think in that environment, when you're certainly fighting, you know, like 99%, if you use that, you know, analogy, 99% of one from the occupied Wall Street, you know, 99% is fighting for, you know, to look at that cake cartoon that I kind of started today, you know, fighting for a muffin-sized cake. And then 1% has, you know, a gigantic, you know, 20-foot by 20-foot cake sheet.
The entire rest of the sheet cake,
and
then
they can't finish, right? No matter how much they ate, they cannot finish it. And I think that's what's causing some of this potential animosities and blame and nationalism and all these things that can, you know, and usually do end up bad.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, nice callback on the cake thing, by the way. That was very well done. Rather than, oh my goodness. You know what? I know that I could sit here and do, because I know that I've got more things that I could talk to you about than time would persist. So rather than necessarily ending on the idea that as a result of potentially failed globalization, we're just going to keep on going through the muck. A little, you know, easy sometimes, but what are you reading right now? What are you watching? Is there anything, you know, at the end of the day, once we, you know, once we go home and we're finished talking about globalization and, you know, public spheres and whatnot, what is it that that you're entertaining yourself with right now?
Currently, I'm binge watching with my husband a Spanish show called Money Heist on Netflix.
Oh.
And it's fabulous. It is connected to sort of idea of stealing from the rich. It kind of has Robin Hoodian, you know, elements to it. But I think it is also connected to the 2008 Great Depression. And it's very well done. Very interesting, keeps you on the edge of your seat, and I'm really enjoying it. We are into the third season, and the fourth season hasn't been made yet, but I hope they will make a fourth season of it. So that's what I'm doing, you know, when I close my computer and try to, you know, remove from here. Love spending time with my four-year-old daughter.
She's four already. Goodness.
Yep. 4-year-olds are a lot of fun, although sometimes can be very frustrating. But most of the time, really, really fun. And as far as my sort of research is concerned, I'm sort of thinking, and maybe that's a result of my aging, that I more and more think about my childhood and how I grew up. And I'm thinking of sort of in a broad strokes about a project on everyday life in Yugoslavia, and particularly through looking through media and music and film, and how not only was portrayed, even though absolutely, we cannot reduce the experiences of people to how they're portrayed in a popular culture. So the book would be, in a sense, historical and might include interviews with people. The one thing that, you know, is now a really interesting phenomena in a former Yugoslavian states is Yugo nostalgia, or nostalgia for, you know, times that people feel has been lost. And what is even a more interesting phenomena is that people who've been born after the fall of Yugoslavia feel nostalgic for those times. And so that phenomena really interests me, and would love to maybe go on a sabbatical, do some interviews and research. And I parallelly with that see a documentary emerging. I am no expert in documentary making, but I have sort of ideas and images that, you know, could very well be told in a documentary form, and would look forward to maybe learn and work with a group or get a grant to do something like that. So that's my sort of a large 10-year project that I would like to embark as soon as I'm done with the faculty council chairing, which takes a lot of my time. It's my pleasure to serve the faculty in that capacity, but it is very time-consuming.
You are a strong and powerful presence and voice for us down there. And that, you know, while most of us, and I'm sure, you know, across campus and department, while we complain to you, we don't say thank you nearly enough. So thank you for doing that. Dr. Marina Wojniewicz, associate professor. Oh, she winced as I butchered that, but I'm so sorry.
That's perfectly fine.
She's affectionately known as Dr. V, by all of the students. Yeah. So we'll go with that.
Yeah.
Dr. V, associate professor of communication here at Monmouth University. Thank you so much for sitting down with me today.
Thank you, Nick, for the opportunity.
All right, folks. Make sure you check out the rest of the interviews and profiles that myself and my colleague Matt Harmon are doing here with our coworkers and the faculty and staff of the Communication Department at Monmouth University. We'll see you for another episode soon. Bye-bye.